Yes, folks, capitalism is a long, long horror story. And we're going to be talking about that today with my co-host. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular host of Wednesday Talk Radio. That's us. And I'm here with Jonathan and Sarah with Portland Assembly to talk to you about more scary stories from the housing crisis.
Hi, Sarah. Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. With my cup of tea, waking up slowly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, a good scary intro gives us that little boost for the morning. So we're going to talk about a few things this week. We're going to talk about sweeps, which are stepping up. It's a seasonal thing. You wouldn't think that they would increase when the weather gets worse, and yet they do. We're going to hopefully hear some calls, have some calls from some folks who have experienced that, who have some stories to tell us. And then we have some stories, too, about our personal experiences in the housing market that are pretty scary. And if you want to call in and share yours, that's great as well.
503-231-8187.
That's that number. I feel like personal stories is a good place to start.
I think so. We have been, it's October, so we're watching a lot of horror movies, right? And there's this common theme that we've seemed to notice, right? That there's like...
Oh, yeah. I want to talk about this for sure. I've been having a lot of thoughts about the way that American horror movies focus on property and place. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. And we also see a lot of ties also in American horror to domestic violence and housing. And that's something I think that is becoming a more predominant connection for people. Just in social media, I see it commented on more frequently that if people had free access to housing, domestic violence might not be such a problem. Yeah. And I see a lot of roots in this. So we've all kind of noticed that American horror is focused on the loss of place for indigenous people and indigenous genocide. Those are themes that are reoccurring.
Mm-hmm. Pet cemetery comes to mind, right?
Right. Yeah. Also, enslavement is a huge theme, like our history of enslavement and genocide against the African community. And one of the things that I'm realizing watching horror movies this month is that is all intrinsically connected to our ability to access housing. So if in this country for the first, 100, 150 years, you had to be a white man to own property, that means that everybody who was not a white man was dependent upon those people for housing security. Mm-hmm. And I feel a lot of that tension and that anxiety in these films I'm watching, and I find that very interesting.
Yeah, not to mention the corruption with the patris, right? The father turning on the family who now owns the home is a very, very continual theme, it seems like. I mean, what was it? The Shining is a really good example of that, right? Taking care of that whole house.
And of course, The Shining was supposedly the structure was built on a native burial ground.
Right.
Everybody knows that.
Yeah, exactly. So, you've got layers and layers there. So, I don't know. I've been thinking about that a lot in the last few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of connecting it to our current housing crisis calamity.
and just to refresh for people who may not be up on that, we've been covering a bit of this kind of portion that relates to Portland about how Wall Street has become the biggest landlords in the world and are currently using that capital that they've invested in property to continue their acquisition of property and also drive up the rent costs, which are now included in new derivative packages that you can invest in. So they're effectively kind of collecting all the pieces of this pie, like the tradition of the, the expansionary white culture has done, and accumulating it and driving the price up artificially to the point that the money supply is probably not going to keep going. So they're really putting everybody at an existential risk the same as they did in 2007, 2008. So it really is the same horror story again.
Well, and now I'm seeing like a new development. Like I watched one the other night, or tried to. I couldn't finish it. That was about a condo that was built in an old slaughterhouse, which I've actually been to somebody's condo that was built in an old slaughterhouse.
That's kind of amazing itself, right?
Right? Yeah. But then the condo was trying to kill all the people that lived inside of it. And I was like, this is really like openly symbolic, but of course it was also very bad. So yeah. I'm sorry.
Did somebody genuinely think it was terrifying though? That's the question.
Oh, right? I'm sure that they did. But there's like a whole new like realm of horror coming out that's about that secondary housing market, which is very interesting. Or people who are trapped, you know, that's a common theme also, that people are trapped in their homes because of their investment in it and can't get out despite the fact that their home is trying to kill them. Isn't that in Poltergeist? Isn't that one of the things that a theme, is that they've sunk all their money into this house, and despite the fact that it's driving them all to kill each other, they can't leave it?
Yeah, I think that's that they couldn't afford to leave.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it isn't a major theme just sort of the basic homeowner's fear of invasion?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Fear of the other. That's some Occidental.
I have a personal fondness for the Purge franchise. Mm. Although I don't care at all about the first two, which are about white homeowners' fear of invasion, like very specifically. The third one and the fourth one become more about the way that the government like poses itself against poor people, basically.
That was the one you were watching the other day. That was really good. That was actually kind of like shaking my boots, because it was literal militia, like Klan militias.
Well,
sweeping.
That was the fourth one. That's the Purge movie, the only Purge movie that was shot by a black director.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it takes place primarily, takes place in a black community, and speaks more explicitly to the ways that the government uses control methods against poor communities, and especially the way that it affects housing. So,
and that's definitely related. It's almost as if this whole wave of pushing the American dream as the way to expand has this kind of shadow going on, right?
It's almost as if.
Yeah, the nightmare.
There's
beneath.
Some sort of repercussion for all this expansionary violence. You know, actually, just a little bit of good non-scary news. I've been seeing for Indigenous Peoples Day, the Yakima tribes declared that they wished to dismantle the dams on the Columbia River. That's been now endorsed by the Lummi tribes. I'm super excited about that.
Based upon a critique of the doctrine of discovery.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's really good to see that progress is being made, like to actually like force decolonization.
That's cool. A doctrine of discovery. I feel like that's relevant. Do you mind elaborating a little bit on that for people who may not know?
Oh, good call.
Well, people should first of all go to the Cable Evening News from yesterday and listen to my interview with Mark Charles, who's actually a Diné or Navajo presidential candidate, which is interesting. Ah. And he was in town, and is still in town. It actually is in town tonight. I could mention that. Up at the, 3900 block of Northeast Shaver. It's the Great Spirit United Methodist Church. And that's at 5:30 this evening. Anyway, that's something people should check him out. He's very, very interesting. He's one of the people really been studying and talking about the doctrine of discovery, and he's got a new book out on it. Okay, so yeah, quickly, that is the basically the doctrine that was based on Catholic edicts, the papal bulls, which basically somehow gave the Christian nation conquerors the supposed right to plunder, enslave, and expropriate the lands of the indigenous peoples around the world, which they proceeded to do in remarkably efficient fashion and bloody. And and that got incorporated into federal Indian law through some fundamental Supreme Court decisions, Johnson v. McIntosh and the Cherokee Nations case and others. And as recently as 2005 with a Ruth Bader Ginsburg decision in the Oneida Nations case, founded the United States claims to all the lands on the doctrine of discovery. That's it.
So it was a Christian sort of rationalization and justification for genocide and land theft.
I think that's super interesting and relevant to our discussions previously with Jackie Wang, especially about the differentiation and identification of the other who is worthy of destruction, right?
Mm-hmm.
The evil one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's. I mean, there's a reason that people say that this is a Christian nation, regardless of the fact that most people do not worship or go to church, mm-hmm. And that is that we are based on some very fundamentally Puritanistic ideals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff.
But one specifically that gave them the kind of motivation to gain territory by way of being superior, right?
Well, that's the unique thing about America is that we've managed to take this Puritan concept of who deserves and who doesn't and integrate it into capitalism in a way that is pretty inextricable,
mm-hmm.
That justifies anything we choose to do as capitalists. So yeah. It's real handy.
And it seems to be tied to the ability to generate life. Like the shadow is the fuel for capital is a really kind of running theme in these horror movies we're noticing, right? Like, oh, mm-hmm. this used to be somebody's place. Ooh,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how are we going to see this play out in the coming fall of the economy? Because they're saying January, right? That's what I hear. That's scary.
Ooh.
Yeah, collapse.
It's definitely coming, though.
Yeah,
but we've been saying that, so, you know, we're always a scary story here on Wednesday morning.
Well, that might be something to talk a little more about. I've been reading our colleague Meg's dire posts about the... you know, the fact that we've never really exited the bubble, we just keep creating worse bubbles, and that the signs are not good.
Oh, yeah. Actually, a really fun, glib comment from Meg about that. There's a new breed of flipper, and it's an algorithm, and there's a new financialized loan product, the fix and flip, which doesn't actually require the fix part. Also, the effort to privatize Fannie and Freddie, combining that with a massive seed funding and VC funding around financial tech, property tech, CRE tech, construction tech, and unprecedented liquidity, and the granularity of share titles with blockchain. Basically, we've got computers driving our economy into the ground based around property, and that's the real horror story. And they're continuing to do it, and it's going to be kind of like a weird cyber tech, you know, automatic RoboCop sweeping you out of your
Well, I mean, now you see on Facebook, you see these ads for companies that'll just sell your house for you or buy you a house, and you can just put in the requirements and then
a lot of form.
Are we? Do you have a caller? Is that
yeah?
What
the you looked at the screen behind you, which sometimes is working to show us. But we do have a caller apparently. If we want to go to the caller right now,
that would be great. Hey, caller, what's up?
Good morning. It's Lisa from Right to Survive.
Oh, hi, Lisa.
Great show so far this morning.
Thanks. Are you scared?
I'm very scared. I see it happening all the time. More and more people from the community Right to Survive serves is becoming houseless and not being able to recover and get back into housing or get back on their feet.
Do you have some sweep stories to tell us?
Oh, I could write a book, 101 sweep stories, just from the last 2 or 3 weeks. Unfortunately, I don't have time. I'm driving right now, and I don't have a hand-free device. But
oh, don't say that on the radio.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, I'm sure my boss is listening. great show, and you know, it's home, and it's so true, everything you're saying. And I see the correlation between the horror films and reality that's going on right now.
Well, so thanks for calling in, Lisa.
Yep. You have a great day.
You too. Drive safe.
Please thanks. Drive safe.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in. So Lisa and I actually were on the Right to Survive show last week and heard some pretty heavy sweep stories. And, you know, hearing stories from the community that's affected directly is always going to be different. It's very important for us.
That's mourning the death of the Sunnyside Community Center as well.
Oof, yeah. Like, that was one of the big things we talked about on that show, actually, was that the... the things that have been going on over at Sunnyside, and honestly, I'm not going to go into the personal loss, which has been pretty considerable and heartbreaking over there, because that's not something I want to make light of. But I one of the things that is kind of terrifying is the response of police and the city to what's going on over there.
The so-called religious community moving in and moving everybody out, right?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean...
Well, maybe you should let people know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay, so we used to run a warming shelter over at Sunnyside Community Center, and that was something that we had started doing the last couple of years to assist with the already extensive programming that had been going on there for the last almost 40 years, run by Pat Schweibert and Sunnyside Community House.
Mm-hmm. Now Beacon PDX, just plug in.
Now Beacon PDX, check them out online, give them your money, they're looking for new space. Anyway, so we have been helping out over there for the last couple of years, building community, doing some kind of groundbreaking things with warming shelter models, I think. You know, we are disturbed that the city's funded warming shelters don't provide food for people, and we make sure that people get fed. We run non-hierarchical models. The Montevilla Emergency Warming Shelter is also a Portland Assembly project, and it has been running for even longer. We try to make a really open, zero-boundary, welcoming space for the community. And that was something that we were able to do at Sunnyside because they understood our model. And we had been planning for this upcoming winter when we heard that a new congregation was going to be moving into the church, which had been just running social programs, basically, and renting out. And that new congregation decided that they did not want to continue any of the programs, social programs, that were being run out of the church. They asked us to leave. They asked Sunnyside Community House to leave, and the community that was built there. Since then, folks unaffiliated, well, some affiliated with us, but have been doing feeds in the park across the street. So we've been having picnics with our friends, with the blessing of the school that is adjacent, who have always been incredibly supportive to Sunnyside and the projects there. And we've been getting a really ridiculous amount of feedback. Our folks, the community there has been swept repeatedly, three times in a week, which is pretty unprecedented, once with SWAT teams and the district attorney in attendance.
Rod Underhill.
So I'm not sure what prompted that.
This is like Southeast Taylor...
34th and Yamhill.
Yamhill, yeah.
SWAT team on a schoolyard at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday morning with kids on the playground.
Talk about a horror story, though.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm going to say that the way that I see our city putting people on the street to torment people who are already living on the street, that's a horror story to me.
Well, that sounds just like The Purge we just watched. Like
it's not far away. I told you in the third movie, there's something that makes my heart like swell, which is that a group of Black revolutionaries have started an underground shelter for folks to get people in off the street when this government-sanctioned purge happens, you know?
Yeah, they're going to side with the capitalists, and it's going to be all war.
We know we have to protect ourselves and each other, like, and we know who we have to protect ourselves and each other against. So yeah, it's actually been really disheartening to see the way that the city has spent so many resources to come after people just trying to share food. You know, we clean up after ourselves. There's no nuisance. It's just literally people trying to live in public space, and that is something that is becoming more and more criminalized, which I find really concerning.
So I have heard a number of people kind of try to insult or dehumanize the houseless population by comparing them to zombies, which I find particularly symbolically interesting, because my understanding of zombie films is that they tend to correlate with economic recession in popularity. Mm-hmm. And so that, as an origin story, is a lot more interesting to me, because specifically zombies gained their notoriety, I believe, through the Haitian Revolution. And it was actually a tactic used by the enslaved population to intimidate the colonizer, right? They thought that they had these voodoo powers that made them beyond, you know, capacity strong and, like, come back from the dead. And mm-hmm. so you can even see that there's this precedent for anti-blackness in the dehumanization around property. And, like, we're seeing that play out here because of the majority of the people who are making these really wild claims, like at that Montevilla meeting, or anybody else who's basically trying to have people disappeared by the city. Like, why aren't the cops just taking people off the street? All right, is that that's the city we want to live in, where we have basically kind of a plainclothes team that sees and looks if you're scruffy or not, and then sends the cops up after you? Like, that's kind of what we're looking at, right? And it's interesting to think about those themes through the policies that they're enacting, because if the fear that they're stoking in these suburban populations is this fear of the other and the fear of the outsider, and they're kind of playing mediator, aren't they just writing the script? Aren't they just participating in those tropes and continuing this whole, you know, horror story that we're seeing play out, that there is a reason these people are out here, that they deserve it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't have a whole lot of hope for that necessarily.
Let's give the call-in number again real quick. Yeah. It's 503-231-8187.
It looks like we do have a caller.
Oh, hey.
Go ahead, caller, and identify yourself, please. Hello, caller.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Wow, really? That was fast. Thank you very much, Paul. I like your show.
It's our show, actually. This is the third Wednesday with Jonathan and Sarah and myself. Thank you.
I like Paul's show, too, though.
Anyway, I really appreciate you talking about this, because so many times, even me, you know, who's pretty aware and pretty progressive, you know, sometimes I feel really uncomfortable, you know, like even saying hi to somebody who might be, you know, sitting on the sidewalk with a sign, or somebody who might be walking along in the same direction as I. And, you know, I'm working on myself, you know, not pretending like I don't see somebody.
Right on.
You know, that, you know, there's no harm in saying hi. You know, you don't have to ask how's it going. You know, you don't have to give them $5 or anything. But, and, you know, I very often don't have any money to give at all, but I try to say hi just because. And, you know, maybe one of the reasons why, you know, our government gets away with this disgusting harassment is because so many people just like to pretend they're not there, or, you know, maybe they're not pretending they're not there. Maybe we don't know what to say.
Well,
pardon me?
No, that's totally accurate. And if anything, I think that is a reflection of the kind of, I mean, capitalism structurally creates that poverty to motivate you to work, is how it feels a lot of the time. So you being, you know, removed from that and accepted from that means that you're saved. And that was this original fear of the colonies, that whether or not you were saved and the people who are outside of it weren't saved and they're dangerous and evil. And so you don't want to think of yourself in that position, but it could be us tomorrow. 10 million people left homeless last time they did this.
That is exactly right. I'm a paycheck away.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people
Most of us are,
right,
yeah. Well, and the thing is that dehumanization is what allows us to look past this happening. And you know, we actively are participating in, we as housed people are actively participating in what happens to houseless people. And if we have to actually look at them in the eye and acknowledge them as a human, it makes it more difficult for us to just allow that to continue.
We shouldn't. We shouldn't allow it to continue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I'd like to make a call up. Have a backpack that they haven't used in ages and ages and ages. Go downtown and, you know, ask somebody who's carrying a plastic bag around if they want it.
Yeah, definitely.
That's just a small kind of thing.
It's getting cold. Yeah, if you got old jackets, people could take them.
Yeah, beaconpdx.org is a good place to go to donate. We also, Portland Assembly will...
Can you say that again?
I can. Beacon, B-E-A-C-O-N, P-D-X dot org is their website.
Got it.
And then we do lunch in Sunnyside Park on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday afternoons. And that's a great place to just bring stuff you have to donate. And there'll be people there who are happy to take it off your hands.
I do believe in November, not to self-promote too much, but we're trying to have a free store for that purpose of warm things and holiday stuff for people. So.
Oh, yeah, and tarps. So, yeah, it'll be aimed at a free store aimed at getting warm weather gear or cold weather gear, rather, and then also gifts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, okay. Thank you so much.
And, the last thing I want to say is if there are any women listening, call up. Thank you. Bye.
Right on.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, the number is 503-231-8187. You are listening to Wednesday Talk Radio. This is one of the talk radio shows aired every weekday morning from 8 to 9 here on your community radio station, KBOO. I'm Paul Roland. I'm here with Jonathan and Sarah as every third Wednesday. And we are sharing scary stories from the housing crisis, the perpetual housing crisis. I think the idea that we've ever had a time without a housing, some form of housing crisis, is certainly an illusion. The idea that we should have to pay rent,
yeah,
is a bit of a crisis.
Really,
anyway,
is.
It looks like we got another caller. Go ahead, you're on the air. Hello.
You want to hear what really ruined Portland? It's Portlandia, if you want to bring movies into this. Most people wouldn't even throw a dart at a map to find Portland as a home if it wasn't for the show Portlandia. And it drove a huge increase into the way we had originally kind of lived in the city, where I would work maybe 30 hours a week, would have a two-bedroom apartment in 2009, 2008. Just after, you know, college during the economic crisis. And bam, wow, did my life change. I had to start working 45 hours just to afford that same spot. So, I mean, you want to talk about systematic enslavement of robbery of time. All of a sudden, I have to work an extra 40 hours a month to afford things. I had a great landlord. His name was Jack, and I'll try to finish it. He didn't raise my rent for 6 years in one location. Bless that guy. And I've had a homeless person living in his truck, and he was stuck there reading a book every night, trying to keep warm. Not once did I approach him. I should have said something, but I just wanted to give him the space. I didn't, you know, bother him, ask him what he's doing.
Yeah.
I saw his family intervention, trying to get him out and maybe, you know, give him a different, you know, well-being or whatever. But I love your guys' topic. I love the fact that you guys are working hard. Everyone should have a place to put their head down and rest. So keep it up.
Right on. Thank you.
Well, you want to briefly talk about that Portlandia or not?
Because just kind of, I don't know, transphobic. There was a lot going on there that I didn't like. And I definitely do think it brought more attention, but was it... Is that chicken or egg? I mean, I often wonder if it was actually just used as marketing for Portland developers. There's so much that is marketing for developers to come to Portland that we don't know about.
Yeah, they
can't stop.
Ooh, first up.
We shouldn't get into that today, but
no, but I mean, just briefly, I do think you're right.
Look it up.
I think Fred Armisen's from New York, and I think that they had laws here that were susceptible to it, and they probably promote it. I mean, they definitely like to do stuff. That's really the horror story, is that when you think about media as a general means for social control through influencing beliefs and behaviors. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if So we know that the CIA mm-hmm. can be like, hey, Hollywood, we need a movie about that. And they're basically just going to cook it up for them. And I think that we see that principle like translated now to smaller entities.
Oh, that's public relations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Spike Lee makes movies for the NYPD. So like, mm-hmm. what do we do, you know?
Don't trust the media.
Yeah, well.
Well, we've got a full slate of callers.
Wow.
Seem to have sparked a lot of interest. I just want to ask the callers to just, as you come on, just to say your name so we know who we're talking to, if you feel comfortable doing that. And so let's go to our next caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, my name is Erin, and I'm a researcher at the University of Oregon. Can you hear me okay?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Hey, Erin.
Great. Yeah, a lot of my work is around the relationship between sweeps of houseless folks and exposure to environmental hazards. Uh-oh. Things like floods, landslides, soil, air pollution, noise pollution, things like that. And over the past year or so, I've interviewed almost 50 people, representatives from different houseless communities across the U.S. And one of the things that we hear over and over is just as police sweeps in downtown and residential areas push people into kind of the margins of the city, people become more and more exposed to different kinds of hazards. And if houseless folks express concerns, obviously, you know, they risk further displacement and eviction. And yeah, we just see this cycle of criminalization, exposure to environmental hazards, and eviction sort of going hand in hand.
Yeah.
I used to work right over by Baker's Tick on the Springwater Trail, and you see, I mean, every year, when this time of year exactly, things are going to start flooding. People who have been pushed to that area are now going to have to leave or risk losing all their stuff you know, personal harm. So, like, even these places that when we push people, you know, we push people out of spaces that would be safer for them to live, you know, in marginal green spaces by freeways. People
right.
hit by cars all the time. Like,
yeah, not
well. And speaking of freeways, I can share a quote from somebody that I interviewed. They were talking about just how difficult it is to find shelter in places that are free from environmental hazards. Mm-hmm. And they said, "There's been a so this is an outreach worker, an organizer in the Bay Area." They said there's been a huge increase in sweeps in the last 3 months is when they've started where the DA has actually been filing the public lodging misdemeanor, giving them out like hotcakes. Something I've seen that's really concerning, we're seeing a huge increase in people sleeping hard with no tent or tarp and by themselves. Last week on outreach, this woman I spoke with in the morning, the cops woke her up and took her tent. They're taking people's tents even if they're not up and saying it's illegal. They can either confiscate it or arrest her. They took her tent, gave her a misdemeanor. In the afternoon, she was under the freeway. She was exhausted and got a tarp and tied it to the fence and slept under there and got a second misdemeanor for sleeping. Both of them were for sleeping. And the person talked about the freeway overpass is toxic. They said, because of the exhaust and the constant fumes and everything, for the folks under the freeways, air pollution has been a concern. But it's less of a concern than the sweeps. It's safer for people under freeways than in more heavily policed areas, even though the conditions are horrible.
Well, even with the thank you so much for telling that story,
yeah.
But here with the conversation we were trying to have with the Central East Side Industrial Council to find mm-hmm. a safe sleep site after they had promised that.
Brad Molson.
Yeah, Brad has his eye on a lot of sites in town that apparently had been thought to have been unwanted before that. But these are all sites, all of the sites that were offered were kind of either needed to be remediated or were really near freeways. So even the spaces that the city are saying are okay for people are, you know, toxic and harmful and dangerous.
But even
yeah, and picking up on what I think it was Paul who said this just a few minutes ago, that this is not like a new housing crisis, and particularly for Black and Native folks, and similarly the exposure to environmental harm. You know, we know that that people along lines of race, in particular, are overexposed to environmental hazards, and it gets exacerbated and kind of you know, morphs in cumulative ways in that, for the houseless community. But I also, just in closing, want to mention that there are a lot of folks who are really working hard to bring attention to this stuff and to counteract it all across the West Coast and increasingly the U.S. as well. People trying to establish villages specifically for Black, by and for Black people in Oakland as well as Portland. We've got, there's a lot of work happening too. So join a group.
Organize. And all right.
That's really interesting with this theme of horror we keep talking about in American horror. The backdrop is always these kinds of results of capitalism, it seems like. Like, that's the thing they're going to scare you with, is that they are going to torment you endlessly and you're going to be, you know, looking like you're possessed because you can't control yourself.
Should we go to the next caller? All right. Who we got?
Ugly Laws.
Hi, Wade.
Hey, Wade.
Hey, I wanted to echo a previous caller about the aversion some folk have to people on the streets. So I was in Bellingham in 2009, and I just, you know, had a business a few months before, but I couldn't. The thing I noticed most was that, and I didn't approach anybody about money. So, but the thing was. I couldn't believe that they were just even afraid to look at me, but that was the first thing. It seemed they seemed to be afraid, and I wasn't a fear. I didn't think I was producing any fear. And then I read this in a Herman Hesse book, and he liked to vagabond around a bit. And he didn't. I don't know if he did it by choice or not, but of course anybody that observed him wouldn't know if he was doing it by choice. But he said the same thing, that they thought it could just happen to them, and just the fear. Even if they've got thousands of dollars in the bank, things happen, right? But anyway. Even if it didn't happen, but the thing that just the potentiality of it being there, you know, they didn't like. So if they avoid it, then they think they can, you know, stay away. But I heard this the shelterless or homeless folk in New York has now approached the Depression era population.
Mm-hmm. And 27.
And yet we're living in a supposedly a wild stock market, and, right? And there's all this, everything seems to be great there.
Actually, the two are related.
So, yeah, that's
like you might not know, but those are correlated.
Depression or something. It works for some, but anyway, hey, one more thing, just because it brought up New York. When I lived there, I was new there, and it was the first time back in 78 that I'd ever seen so many folk needing or approaching me for money. And so I didn't want to be ungenerous, but I also didn't know who was genuine. And so I decided I would give the magic pocket, which happened to be all the change that was in my pocket. It could be 25 cents or it could be $2. I figured something else, some other energy knew more about this person's plight than I did, but
yeah, man, I hear you. Hey,
interesting. Yeah. Thank you for calling and for sharing your stories.
One other thing, people often say God bless you, and I just say she does, and that's why I do these things.
All right. Right on.
Yeah, have a good night.
Thanks, man.
All right, have a good one. You know, it's interesting. It's silly little thought, I guess, but you know, now that everybody's going to plastic, people don't have much change in their pockets anymore. Actually, it's probably a real thing.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's kind of is a little bit anti-poor the way the technology progresses, but
I mean, it's very anti-poor. Yeah, like the things that, like, yeah, don't get me started on TriMet.
Hot passes.
But yeah, no, like I budget and like keep cash in my pocket just because of that, because it is so like hard now.
Yeah, because it almost seems ridiculous to talk about this because it seems like. Such a small gesture in a way, but I know that when I give people on the street change, it makes a measurable difference to them, even just momentarily, and you know, it accumulates. But yeah, I mean, that's a good idea to keep change in your pocket,
because
it feels, you know, it's easier just to give change. You know, we all have this thing about, you know, we're all caught up in all this psychological stuff, but, you know, giving bigger bills, you know, anyway.
It's, well, I think honestly, it doesn't matter how much. It's it's an excuse for interaction.
Yeah.
Like, it gives you a moment to actually see that person as a human, hopefully, and, like, have an interchange. Like, it's I'm going to say that sometimes probably not about the money for them either. Like, like, we are just people, and we need other people. Like,
and that stat that they brought up, I know for a fact that we just hit record highs of rents in New York, and that's what we're talking about. That rent price is literally driving this stock market. There is nothing else. There's no people doing work and creating goods that's making that value happen. It's literally just conjured wealth by these awful, awful, you know, techno magistrate wizards, evil wizards, and that's the result, is that we get this psychology of fear driving that. Oh, it can't be me. Like, I don't want to end up there.
Well, and one thing I've noticed, so I go to a lot of neighborhood association meetings, which is a drag, but try it sometime. And there is a different response. Like, I feel that people in less affluent communities are more afraid of houselessness in a visceral way. Mm-hmm. And that's understandable. But when I go to neighborhood association meetings and say Laurelhurst, the concerns are generally about property, harm to property. Whereas in less affluent communities, people are more concerned about physical harm. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I see being stoked by the increased and visible presence of police in those communities. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a difference because, like, people who live in rich neighborhoods know that the cops are always right there if they need them. Whereas people who live in poor neighborhoods are policed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that helps to sort of enervate that fear in the community.
Yeah. And it creates stress where if you have cops there pushing out these other people and you think that you might end up like them, they're now, you know, tangentially aimed at you. And mm-hmm. so you're trying to deflect the whole problem from your community. I just want a nice neighborhood. I don't want any of these problems.
Yeah. So if people in poorer communities are seeing this vitriolic and violent language from homeowners and seeing these homeowners use the police as a weapon, which is what they do, which is what they're for,
mm-hmm.
then that even stokes that fear higher. So that's really interesting. I think we have one.
Yeah, we only have 15 minutes left, and we still have a couple callers, and maybe someone else wants to call in quickly at 503-231-8187. Let's go to the next caller. Go ahead and identify yourself, please.
My name is John, J-O-H-N, and I know that I don't like make assumptions, but I know that you're not Ivy League sociologist, economist, and political scientist. But I know there's going to be a downturn coming just because I've been hearing that the Federal Reserve has been pumping billions of dollars into the big banks.
Trillions. Almost. Just got another trillion, just saying, sorry.
Yeah. Well, there's something going on if they have to print, you know, funny money.
Oh, yeah.
And just to get to the core of my question, okay, now, you know that a lot of people are living on the edge everywhere, and if the next economic downturn is going to, it's not going to be recoverable because how so much we're in debt. When Obama bailed out the banks and stuff, we still had a little bit of cushion, but now we don't.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's even getting, even, well, you talk about scary worse, you know, I mean, we're on the verge of a world war, but that's another matter, okay? So you think that maybe there'll be a next next presidential candidate coming in or whatever. I'm not even crossing my fingers on that.
Mm.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Yeah, don't. but I just wonder if there would be a new philosophy of, you know, handling, you know, when the housing crisis gets to the point that you have like Hoovervilles back in the 30s, that there would be, you know, a reconstruction of a society itself, you know, like maybe going back to the poor houses or, you know, building, you know, huge, you know, affordable housing like they did in the 60s, where there was, you know, I don't know, like John Lindsay, you know, he was a big, you know.
We recommend a combination of expropriation and free community housing.
Okay. Okay, well, I'm just saying that there's, this housing thing, homeless thing, is going to, you know, really explode on the next downturn.
Yes, it is.
I mean, really, it's so, especially when stagnation of the wages, they won't even do you even, you know, a couple dollars more an hour, less 15.
So
I just wonder what's your view if it turns out to be, you know, oh my gosh, you know, like literally thousands, if not tens of thousands of people are homeless.
Well, okay, well, we got a couple other callers, so we got the question. Thank you so much for calling in, John. We have a response, and we'll go to our next call.
Super quickly, just because that was a really intensely good setup, because there's some key history that's really important there. The Hoovervilles were not the answer. That was kind of the result of this willy-nilly capitalist-run speculative economy that burst it in the 20s, and then like the fallout of that lasted all the way until the New Deal, which was fought for by labor organizing and tons of socialist movements in the United States for a number of years. And that was the culmination of it. And ever since then, the banking and financial class has been trying to destroy that platform. And it wasn't even that good. But that was the origination of this kind of animosity that turned into neoliberal politics. And now they've gassed out this colony. Like, there's no incentive for capitalists to invest in the people here that would create value, because it's all speculative. So they're just gassing it out until it hits the floor, and then they're just vacationing wherever else and letting the fallout occur. Like, they do not care at all. That's the scary thing. They are going to let this thing go right off a cliff, and they're going to retire somewhere else.
Indeed.
Well, oh, I was just going to say that one of the differences also is that back in the 20s when the crash happened, there was land that people could utilize.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we weren't, like, Sullivan's Gulch was a Hooverville, and nobody stopped anybody from building a shack there because they understood that people needed to live.
Well, plus there's space there's no space like that anymore.
I mean, you can't even sit somewhere in public and not pay for your space at this point. So, yeah.
And not to mention, the threat of this world war is very real, because the only thing that pulled this economy out of it was the world wars.
Yeah.
Yeah, start talking about that, then we'll really scare ourselves. What, you know, the response to, you know, economic chaos, inability to deal with economic chaos, and the inability to deal with the uprising against economic chaos. War is always a good response by the capitalist class. So let's go to our next caller. Go ahead. You are on the air.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. Good morning.
Okay. Hey, a specter is haunting the world, right? you know, I've been obsessed with this idea of producers and parasites. And I want to turn the zombie thing on its head a little bit.
Mm.
It seems to me, you know, Thomas Frank in Listen Liberal, you know, made the point that these so-called meritorious people have taken over the Democratic Party. They have, you know, they're affluent, college-educated people. And the Democratic Party has abandoned the working class and poor people and labor unions. And then David Graeber came out with his book, BS Jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically lays out how a lot of these college-educated middle management types actually do nothing. They produce nothing. So it's like they are the zombies. That, like, we have the vampire squid at the top, as Matt Taibbi told us about Goldman Sachs and the and the financial elites, but then there's this zombie army of people who are like carrying out the vampire's orders, these middle management highly educated yuppies, basically, and the people, the hosts, are the actual producers, the army of unemployed, the reserve army of labor, the poor, the working class people. We are the hosts for the parasites. We are the actual producers, and they are feeding off of us. That's the real horror story. So I'll leave it there. Thanks.
No, legit.
I've always found, so the world of academia is a place where that's really clear. Even if we go down to like grade schools, I used to teach after school programs. And one of the things that you can see is that all of the money goes into bureaucracy. And none of it goes into actual operations or paying teachers. Or there's a reason that, you know, teachers have to buy their own pencils, but like state school superintendents go on multi-million dollar vacations.
And we should all read Hannah Arendt.
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I have my...
I have
my quibbles, but yeah.
Bureaucracy's still evil.
That's true.
Yeah.
Did we have another caller?
I think we had another caller. Nope. I guess we lost the last couple callers who weren't able to wait or had to go somewhere or do something, no doubt.
Maybe they weren't using a hands-free.
Oh. No, maybe wait. We do. They're back. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Make sure you're on a hands-free if you're driving.
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, greetings, everyone. Thank you for taking my call.
One thing about the how a lot of the homeless problem is they're not considered unemployed. The unemployment rate is 3.8, very low, but you have to receive a government benefit to be counted in that 3.8. So how much of these homeless people are actually unemployed?
Probably not a whole lot.
Well, I mean, a lot of homeless people have jobs. That's something that people find surprising. I blew a woman away the other night by telling her that I knew multiple houseless people who had not just one but two jobs. So, like, that's definitely something to be aware of. But also, I mean, if our government benefits, what is it? I think you get 6 months or something. And our job market has been like this for long enough that people have fallen off those roles. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, absolutely. There are probably millions of people who are unemployed who are not counted in that.
Well, not to mention it's really hard to hold down your checks when you don't have an address, as mm-hmm. far as I understand. So housed people are more likely to use the unemployment cycle, but the structural poverty of when you're not on that list anymore, they don't count those people. That's an estimation.
Yeah, also around the country, here in Portland, we have a very small black population.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to Los Angeles and some of these very large cities, they were saying that 50% of the homeless is African American or Hispanic.
Yeah.
And I was shocked to hear that they were saying that half the total in the country is minorities.
Yep.
But it's not, we don't see it here in Portland.
I will say that there is a disproportionate number of the houseless population in Portland that is black. So,
it is increasing recently.
Over the last 2 years, most metrics have shown that that has gone up. So, although there is, I believe it's 6% black population in Portland, I think it's 16% of the houseless population is black, and that was 2 to 3 years ago. And I have just anecdotally definitely seen an increase in the meantime. So.
Oh, okay. And you were talking earlier about Hoovervilles. Well, in this country, I think like during the 30s, they were called shanty towns.
Mm-hmm. Same
and
thing.
Shanty towns are all over the world. I mean, major cities have them, but they're kind of around garbage dumps,
mm-hmm.
you know, so they can clean up the garbage. But
Say in Rio, you've got favelas, which are a similar thing, but they're not necessarily as heavily policed by the government, so people can actually build infrastructure there, you know, on their own.
Do note that that is because the people resist the state.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they run it themselves a lot of the time.
Okay, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah,
absolutely,
no,
thanks for calling.
Thank you. Well, we have a couple minutes left, so time to get our last thoughts in here.
Real quick, just piggybacking off of that, there is a very good study from the Coalition for Communities of Color in Portland about the state of different demographics, and it is not very good for the Native population either, statistically, for houselessness. They are also overrepresented.
Very overrepresented,
yeah.
I thought we'd close with a little scary story from our personal experience. Now, this isn't about the sweeps, but I wanted to talk about a little building that we went and looked at downtown.
Oh my gosh.
So Jonathan and I and some friends have been thinking about communal housing situations and things like that. So we've been looking at some different spaces, and we came across a property in downtown Portland that seemed like it might be great for us, for a number of people who wanted a performance space in their space as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought we'd go look at it. So we went and looked, and when we got there, I'll preface this by saying that we had an acquaintance who had worked with somebody who had lived in an apartment and had been telling us horror stories about it. They had actually had to move out because of black mold.
Their feet went numb.
Yes. Yeah. So they had vacated.
Out of work for 2 months.
So we arrived at this apartment, at this house or building to look at it, and it started to occur to us that this was awfully close to the place that our friend had told us about.
And it smelled and creaked. Well,
first, the owner rolled up in his convertible.
With his matching red paint and newsboy cap.
To show us the place. He took us up the stairs, which were anchored to the wall with chains and had clearly collapsed at some point.
Yeah.
That's not good.
When we asked him questions about the URM, unreinforced masonry, which this building obviously was, he said that he didn't know anything about it. And then he told us that the previous residents had taken a sink out and turned a bathroom into a sleeping area because they wanted more sleeping space. But you could smell the mold in that room.
Which was, in fact, where it came from, where they had a bathroom previously.
Our friend told us that in his bathroom, the mold would not stop growing out of the sink, and so they had to remove it. So, and this was without disclosure, and it's right downtown. So keep your eyes open.
They're the horror story.
Yeah, landlords are the horror story.
Among thousands and hundreds of thousands of others that people are faced with on a daily basis.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining me again, and look forward to next month. And we're out of time. So thank everybody for calling in and listening, and stay tuned for more great programming. Linda Olson-Osterlin is up next.
Thanks so much.